There is nothing subprime about the video game industry right now. Demand for video games has fueled a market for game software designed especially for tiny mobile devices like mobile phones, BlackBerries, or iPhones. Morning Edition's technology guru Mario Armstrong brought a few devices into our studios to show me what it's all about. So you've brought a variety of handheld devices here. You've got the pretty red-cased iPhone, I guess.
And that's right, yep. Regular, it's a red case on this iPhone. And then I have a BlackBerry. And then I have a Motorola phone that's just your standard kind of clamshell phone.
So what are some of the more sophisticated games that are out there?
So that's a great question. There are some sophisticated games, like one that I was just going to introduce you to, Super Monkey Ball. You actually control a monkey who's in a little bubble, and he's floating through mazes, and you're trying to pick up bananas and score points.
Wow, sounds like a game show. Okay, it says go. I don't know what the heck I'm doing. I've got a little monkey. It's running around.
So you're tilting ever so slightly, left, right, forward, back.
Oh, every time that I'm leaning this thing, I'm sending the monkey down a ramp, and he's about to fall in the ocean?
That's right. Whoa! So you want to avoid falling in the ocean.
How tragic. That was the sound of the monkey going into the ocean. Okay. So people are making money at these. This is something that you actually pay a premium to do.
That's right. I've actually paid $5.99 to download that particular game from the App Store. And so that was created by Sega, which is a gaming publisher that many people know. And they've been creating mobile games since 2002.
Sure.
So they're not new into this. But what's really has shifted here, I think, when you talk about downloading games and who's making money, if you look at the top 25 of paid games that are on the iTunes store, the application store, that is, for their games, out of all of those, there's only one or two that come from big publishers. Everything else comes from independents or lesser-known video game makers.
The high-tech game people, Microsoft, Nintendo, are they paying attention to this market as a potential competitor?
They are paying attention to it. I don't think they're paying as much attention to it right now. I think they consider this to be a little bit of pocket change. I mean, you do have some of the big publishers actually creating games, Electronic Arts, Sega, and some others that are out there, but not a lot.
We're mostly talking about the iPhone, but you've brought some other devices here. What else you got?
So I have other devices here that have other games, like the classic Pac-Man. Everyone likes a classic game, but
This is a T-Mobile phone,
so you're looking at it.
This is the old Pac-Man screen.
So you're looking at Pac-Man on the screen, and you can see there's a little joystick display.
Indeed there is. Okay, so here we go. My little Pac-Man is chewing these energy pellet things. Oh, and now I have a chance to get the ghosts. I just chewed up a ghost for 200 points. Mario, this is a game from, I don't know, the 80s, I guess.
That's right.
Is this popular again now?
Absolutely. You're seeing some of these old school classics come back in these handheld devices. One of the ways that you can make money in creating these video games is what's called micropayments. Micropayments hasn't really taken off in the U.S., but it's done very well in the Far East. And essentially what micropayments allows people to do are play a game, but then maybe you have to pay in small increments to unlock levels or to open up new features.
So is there some music we could go out on here, Mario?
Yes, there absolutely is. There's a very unique story about a small startup that's in California by Stanford University academics. These are music teachers. And they said, you know what? What if we created an iPhone application? Well, they did just that, and that's this game that turns your iPhone into a flute. Now, let me tell you something. This game has become so popular. The name of the game is Ocarina. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Ocarina. This thing is phenomenal. It has been downloaded 700,000 times and plus some. So they've made close to about $800,000 because it costs 99 cents per download.
All right. So how do I do this? I blow on the microphone, which is right here?
Yep, blow on the microphone.
And it's going to be like blowing across the mouthpiece of a flute.
Oh, the flute. Correct. And then you're going to take your fingers, and you see those little buttons on the display?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to touch those and play the flute.
I'm just blowing across this microphone here, which is part of the phone anyway, and it's catching that sound and turning it into an electronic tone. Okay, I could do that all day.
Well, I got to say, I was impressed by you doing that because it's not easy to do, as you can tell right off the bat.
Mario Armstrong, always good to have you by.
Thanks for having me in, Steve.
He's Morning Edition's regular technology commentator, and he also hosts the show Digital Cafe on Baltimore's public radio station, WYPR. And by the way, while I was playing Mario's iPhone, he pulled out a video camera and started recording my attempts to master the ocarina, which, unfortunately, you can see on our website, npr.org. Turning now to tweets. That is of the instant messaging variety. Twitter is all the rage in social networking, although it has Morning Edition commentator John Ridley twittering with rage.
At the risk of sounding like that old guy in Gran Torino telling those young punks to get off my lawn, it's gotten to the point whenever I hear somebody talking about Twitter or twittering or tweeting, it just makes my little tummy want to hurl. I haven't tweeted once in my life, but I'm sick of hearing about it already. What once may have been the cool way of letting 100 people know you're about to go mow your lawn now has the feel of a used-to-be-fresh means of communication. So, yesterday, like two-way pagers and AOL. To be honest, I think twittering jumped the shark long before ultra-hip CNN got into a Twitter match against super-down Ashton Kutcher. Back when politicians started live-tweeting responses to the president's dimmy State of the Union address, Twitter had already taken on all the cool of your mom getting a tattoo. I imagine, I hope, Twitterers are ultimately headed for the social networking retirement home that's the current residence of Second Life and MySpace. But my real issue with social networking isn't their faddishness. It's the hypocrisy that goes with them. We claim to be a nation of people who take our privacy very seriously. Just mention the idea of warrantless wiretaps and expect to get hit up with a congressional investigation. But give somebody an avatar and a URL, and they can't tweet, post, or hyperlink enough personal information about themselves to as many people as possible. Seriously, does valuable broadband space need to be taken up with announcements in that creepy Facebook third-personese, John is enjoying two-for-one margaritas with the rest of the IT team at TGI Fridays? Where is the expectation of privacy anymore? Or, more correctly, where is the expectation that people will keep their private nonsense to themselves so that those of us who still like to communicate personal information with one person at a time don't have to get caught up in somebody else's email circles or listen to their one-sided cell phone conversations? Now, I don't know what's hipper, to Facebook or to Twitter. I just know, for me personally, discretion never went out of style.
Commentator John Ridley is founding editor of ThatMinorityThing.com. And after ranting about tweets there for a little while, we need to mention that he has a blog called Visible Man at NPR.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and now All Tech Considered. Generally, in this segment, we explore how digital technology is changing the way we live. Well, today we're going to look at how it's also changing the way we die. The internet has brought with it new bereavement rituals and also new legal questions that would have been unthinkable only a few years ago. In a few minutes, we'll talk about this with our regular technology contributor, Omar Gayaga of the Austin American-Statesman. But first, here's NPR's Yuki Noguchi with a consideration of death in the digital age.
Kristen Wiggins is her sorority sister's keeper, in a way. 9 months after 23-year-old Jennifer Lewis's death from ovarian cancer, Wiggins keeps the password to her Facebook account and watches over it.
People use it as a memorial site, in a way, where they go on there and they'll say, you know, I was thinking about you, Jen, I love you, you'll always be missed.
Wiggins does this also to promote the foundation established in Jennifer's name, all with her friend's family's blessing. But there are other examples where keeping the memory of someone alive online becomes far more complicated.
You could imagine three or four siblings having a difference of opinion as to whether to leave something up for memorial sake or not.
John Dozier Jr. is president of the Dozier Internet Law Firm, a practice that sees cases where the law and technology come into conflict. In one recent case, a man's death prompted online looting.
Hackers came in and stole the domain names before the beneficiaries of the estate figured out he owned them. We ended up having to chase them all around the world, and we were fortunate to get them back.
In the past, a person's epitaph might be etched on a gravestone or in a newspaper obituary. That, Dozier says, changes online.
That concept of that being the final statement isn't so in a social networking environment, and you very much have the whiteboard or blackboard effect, where you never know what's going to be said.
Keeping the door open to new messages and photos can not only be painful, it's hard to prosecute defamation in cases where either the poster or the subject is dead.
Personally, I want my Facebook account just gone.
That's Jeremy Toman, whose own failed attempts trying to access his deceased grandmother's email account led to a new business, Legacy Locker. The company's service is essentially a safety deposit box of passwords and account information and instructions to survivors on how they want their online identity handled.
I have currently 15 what I deemed as important digital assets, and these did include, you know, my blog and Twitter, because I do use them for some work things. But they also include my email accounts. I have 6 different email addresses, my GoDaddy, my iTunes store credit.
The service would help his wife contact everyone he works with and let her know whether he'd want to have a continued life online. LegacyLocker.com launched last month and has more than 1,000 members.
That's NPR's Yuki Noguchi, and we're joined now, as we are most Mondays, by Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American-Statesman. Welcome once again, Omar.
Thanks for having me.
Omar, when you die, who owns your email or your Facebook page, for that matter? Is the law actually clear on that?
Well, it really depends on the service. Things like Yahoo Mail and Google's Gmail, they all have different terms of how they handle a person's email or their account after they die. For instance, Yahoo and Gmail, they treated a user's email as private property, and they won't hand over the passwords or the emails to the family members without some serious legal action. Google's Gmail, for instance, requires a copy of a death certificate, copy of a power of attorney document or birth certificate, and an email sent from the account in question. So it's not really an easy thing to do, and it does bring up the issue of, you know, does Facebook own all of that information on your wall, or mm-hmm. do you? Will they open it up to relatives after you've died?
Is this question starting to crop up in people's wills? You know, I leave my Facebook page and login information to my children or something like that?
It absolutely is. You know, that we had at South by Southwest Interactive this year in March, there was a whole core conversation panel devoted to this topic. And it brings up so many thorny legal issues, so many ethical issues of, you know, even if you do have the legal authority to pour through a family member's email or their personal digital content, is it the right thing to do? And sites like Legacy Locker allow you to sort of decide those kinds of things beforehand so that your family members aren't having to question, you know, would they really want to poke through your email? There are plenty of services that will assist you in storing digital information, but sometimes something as simple as keeping a USB drive with all that information and passing it on to someone that you trust, a family member or a friend, that's better than just leaving all these questions unanswered.
What if you want all these questions answered, but you want the answer to be, nobody should have access to my stuff after I die. My email will go to the grave with me. Can you do that? Is there a service that will guarantee their deletion, say, upon your demise?
Well, not that I know of, but sometimes the best way not to have your email tampered with is just to do nothing. Sites like Gmail and Yahoo will delete an account after a certain period of inactivity. And like I said before, legally, it's a little bit difficult for people to get into your email. So sometimes, you know, it'll just go dead after a certain period of time.
Let's turn away from the legal questions here to the cultural ones, which is things like a Facebook page becoming an online condolence book, using the web as a site for mourning and grieving.
Right. That's one way to sort of get around the issue of not having the person's login and password. On Facebook, you can just post on a friend's Facebook wall, and oftentimes mourners will just begin posting their messages of love and their memories on a Facebook wall. There's a whole industry also of memorial sites like Legacy.com. There's one called Gates of Remembrance, eObituary, that are the online equivalent of funeral homes. And just in the way somebody might pre-plan their own funeral, you could try mylastemail.com, where you can set up your own online obituary and your own online tribute to yourself. If you are known in life as a control freak, mm-hmm. your close family and friends will understand the pains you took to get your afterlife virtual condolences right.
And then there are instances of virtual mourning online crossing over to real life, but also to fictional characters.
Right. You know, when Cal Penn's character died on the show House, the Fox TV website set up a virtual memorial for his character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, last year there was a case.
He didn't die. He went to the White House to work there, which is was never heard from again.
And not to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, but he committed suicide on the show and then, yeah, and led to a White House appointment. And then last year there was this case of these online mourners in the game World of Warcraft. They were holding a very solemn funeral for a woman who had died in real life, and it was crashed by an opposing party. They came in and made fun of them and crashed the party, and then they posted an online video about it that became a viral hit. So sometimes online it's hard to get people to take death so seriously.
Well, Omar, thank you once again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American-Statesman and for All Things Considered. And if you have had personal experience of these issues, share them with us and post to our new blog at www.npr.org/alltech. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The latest bit of technology to reach the market could be a boost for struggling newspapers. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos yesterday unveiled a bigger version of his popular digital reader, the Kindle. NPR's David Folkenflik reports.
The Kindle DX is lighter than a thick fashion magazine, easier to read on than a laptop, and capable of storing 3,500 books. People can also pay for electronic subscriptions to newspapers, and a modest number already do so on the original smaller Kindle. Amazon's Jeff Bezos tells NPR their ranks should swell.
People love the fact that they wake up in the morning and their newspapers are already, you know, automatically downloaded onto the device while they sleep. They love the fact that when they travel, their subscription travels with them. Now, with Kindle DX and the larger display, newspapers look even better.
In a test of its appeal, three of the most prestigious newspapers in the country, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Boston Globe, will subsidize the $489 cost of the Kindle DX for selected subscribers who commit to a long-term subscription. Think of it like a cell phone contract.
Newspapers see e-readers as their last best hope.
Sarah Rotman Epps analyzes the media industry for Forrester Research. She says most newspapers haven't succeeded in charging people to read articles online or on mobile devices, but she says that may change.
I think you'll see some newspapers experimenting with all kinds of models in the coming year.
Epps says Bezos may have more success with a different market. Amazon also announced a partnership with major publishers to download big textbooks for students on six college campuses. David Folkenflik, NPR News.